Hello, and welcome to Cinematic Sevens, list of seven films on a simple theme. I'm Stephen, your host, and I'm very happy to welcome to this episode, Scott.
Hello. How are you doing, Scott? Hi, mate. How are you? All good. All good.
Not too bad. Now, listeners might have encountered you before via the Stinking Paws podcast and Rainbow Valley podcast, which you do.
Yes.
Which are great podcasts. So I want to just let people know about them, just in case they don't know who you are.
Well, yeah, those that have been unlucky to come across me in the past will know me from the Stinking Paws podcast with my co-host Charlie. We've been running that show for about 4 years now, 4 years in July, and it's your basic classic movie review podcast. Try and get the show out every fortnight, and we run the gamut from silent movies right up to pretty much the 2000s. We try not to review anything in the past 10 years, but every now and again we'll have a bit of an amnesty, you know, just to try and include some of the newer ones that we feel are worthy of discussion. And I've got a newer project. We're only sort of 8 episodes in on that one, and it's called Rainbow Valley, which is a bit of a passion project for myself. It's the story of the 1960s, which is quite a big topic when you put it that way. But it's in sort of hour-long bite-sized pieces, and each month we take a look at a particular pop star or a news headline or, you know, some of the main events that happened throughout the most interesting decade, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you had everything going on. So sort of things we've included in that is The March to Selma by Martin Luther King, quite a heavy topic. But yeah. Then episode one was the life of Janis Joplin, or we had the Profumo affair, Brian Epstein's story. We've got the 50th anniversary of Sergeant Pepper coming up.
Making of Psycho.
And The Making of Breakfast at Tiffany's, I think, is the next one that's due for release. So a lot of hard work goes into that, but I'm loving every minute of this new one. But Stinking Paws is still my passion with Charlie, because I have a great laugh with him actually doing that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad, because I enjoy both of them, and to have the contrast between, you know, one being mainly the classic films, which I enjoy hearing about, and particularly enjoy hearing your opinions, pair of you, but then, you know, hearing you give an overview of some of the more important stories from the 60s. It's great, because you add extra detail in there beyond what is commonly known, but in an entertaining way. So it's a great listen, in my opinion.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun doing it, but as I say, it's a lot of work. It's more work than I thought it actually would be. You know, it's the scripting of it, as I think I said to you off air, is the toughest part. Recording, editing, that's not so bad. It's getting what you want to say on the page first and getting it right. It does take me a good month to do each episode, but yeah, it's gradually getting a fair size audience now, and I'm getting a lot of positive feedback from it. So it's going to be about for a little bit while to come, which is good.
I'm glad about that, yes. So you're joining me today on this show to discuss a pick of 7 films with a question mark in the title.
Oh, don't I know it.
Which wasn't as easy as either of us thought when we first started making our lists, because there are a number of films that don't actually have question marks in that we automatically assumed did.
Yes.
There was What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which doesn't. You mentioned before, I think,
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Roger Rabbit, yeah.
Has not got a question mark in it. Why?
No.
Why?
Yeah.
I spoke to Charlie about that this morning. I mentioned it. And he come up with some bullshit grammar answer, you know, some English reason why it hasn't. And it just doesn't wash, as far as I'm concerned. There should be a bloody question mark in that title.
Yes, unfortunately. So that, you know, scuppered a certain number of choices we could have made. But we have got 7 each, and some of them may actually duplicate.
Some are a bit tenuous as well, I'll just add.
Yeah, well, yes. But it wouldn't be unusual for you to have some dubious choices in things. So as the guest, I'm quite happy to let you go first.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, before I go into my first choice, I mean, these are in no particular order. I'm not endorsing any of these movies. I'm not saying that number 7 is my least favourite and number 1's my most. I tried to do a little bit of research going into this because I thought, yeah, this is going to be easy. It's not, right?
No.
But when you go into IMDb, did you know there's 1,500 titles that have got question marks at the end of them on IMDb?
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah. 1,490 of them probably are not worth discussing.
Right.
And out of those 10 that were left, I had to try and find either those that I'd watched or try and watch ones that I hadn't before this. So I've been a bit creative with a couple of them, and you're going to have to forgive me for that. But number 7, this might be on your list. If it isn't, I think you'll appreciate it. Go back to the glory days of the 1970s British TV. Okay, you're a big fan of sitcoms of the era, Stephen. Yeah, and commonly, I think you know where I'm going already, it was common in that era for a big screen version of your favourite TV sitcom. So we had like Bless This House, the movie, Dad's Army, Rising Damp, Three on the Buses movies, for God's sake, you know.
Yeah, and I think I know the way you're going on
you
this
You know
one,
where we're going, and the big screen version would usually give us a chance to see your favourite comedy, but with just a little extra sort of sauciness to it, or a different location, perhaps, you know.
Yeah, and some of them were terrible, and some of them actually worked. I mean, Porridge, as we discussed on a previous episode of this show, that actually worked as an extended film version.
Very good version. Dad's Army wasn't too bad as well, if I remember rightly. So. Yeah. Last week, I had this on my list anyway, and last week, being bank holiday weekend, it was Easter Sunday, and I think it was ITV3, they were showing this, and I thought, well, I've got to include it, so I sat and watched a little bit of it. It's Are You Being Served, the movie.
Oh! Right. Yes.
I take it it's not on your list.
It's not on my list. There was two film versions of British TV, and when you were talking, I was 80% sure you were going to go with Are You Being Served? And my other 20% was thinking you were going to go with Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads.
Wow, I didn't even think it was called that. Of course, yeah, Whatever Happened to. Yeah, that would make it a question. Yes.
So, Are You Being Served? The film version, when they actually had some more exterior VT done. Rather than it just being set.
Do you know what? I don't think interior. It was. I think it was all done in a studio.
Was it? My recollection that they had some outside shots for a change. But,
outside shots, but to me, they look like they're filmed indoors. I sat and watched it, but I didn't catch it from the beginning. And to be honest, Stephen, I lasted about 20 minutes and I had to turn it off. I'd seen bits of it before as a kid. You know, it had been shown on TV. And everything's there that you'd expect from a big screen version of a British 70s sitcom. You've got Andrew Sachs playing the Spanish hotel owner. Not a waiter.
No,
but the hotel owner. All your favourite characters, right? You've got John Inman. Now, one of the highlights of the TV show was how creative the writers would have to be to imply that Mr. Humphreys, was homosexual. But they'd have to imply it in a way that would make it masked but funny.
Yes.
In this version, bang, they're blatant about it. They don't care, right? if there was ever any doubt that Mr. Humphreys was gay, there's no doubt by the time you've seen the end of this movie. You've got Mrs. Slocum and her pussy, which still makes me laugh every time I hear that. I don't know why. Captain Peacock, there's toilet gags. And it did surprise me in this wretched age of political correctness that it was still being shown on an Easter Sunday afternoon, because there was a lot of stuff in there that I thought, nowadays, you know, that's a bit close, you know. But I had to include it because it's something that I've seen out of this very narrow list of things that I could choose from.
Well, it's ITV3. I'm sure, like, all five people who are watching, and maybe some of them didn't watch the entire thing either.
No.
But I do believe that when I was younger, I have actually seen the whole thing. Mm. And my recollection of it isn't very strong. But the TV series, obviously, we know what to extrapolate from that. And it was them being more open and more adult than they could be on the television screen, like you say, with all the innuendo and the gags that are a lot more picture postcard and saucy seaside a lot of the time. But yes, you've got all the characters in there you recognise, but if you imagine somebody who's completely new to it sitting down and watching it as a film, I'd dread to think what their reaction would be.
American viewers, especially
in the modern age.
Yeah, and American viewers would not. All right, they've been brought up on Benny Hill and things like that, but
Yeah.
I don't know. I think Are You Being Served did translate quite well over in America. But as you say, to this modern day audience, I don't think it would translate very well at all.
Having said that, you find internationally, you've got Mrs. Brown Boys is quite popular, isn't it? And that's pretty much the same kind of humour.
Only amongst certain people. I can't stand that bloody program.
No, me either.
Mrs. Brown's Boys and Miranda. They're the two that me and Charlie bring those up constantly.
Doing an impression of a horse and falling over.
And falling over. Yeah. A lot of falling over in those two bloody shows. Yeah. Yeah. So that's my number sevens.
Right. My first one then is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Right. Now, I didn't include that because I didn't think it had a question mark.
Oh, yeah. It does, actually.
It does. Yeah. Okay.
Fortunately.
Good, because I can talk about that one with you.
That's an easy one, yeah. So, which obviously the Coen brothers and starring George Clooney, John Turturro, and Tim Blake Nelson. Now, my question to you is, do you like comedies that are charming, clever, in equal measure? Because that's exactly what this is, I think.
It's very clever.
It is, yeah.
Especially when you consider what the source material is as well.
Yeah, I mean, they say loosely based upon the Greek fable of Homer's Odyssey.
Yes.
But I think if you've got any knowledge whatsoever of Homer's Odyssey, I think you'll see it's quite strong in its reference to how it brings in the various elements. Although it's about three escapees from a 1930s chain gang, obviously, as you know, that they're trying to escape so they can collect the loot that's been buried before a reservoir that's been built floods the land where it's buried. But the references to the actual original fable are quite amazing, the way that they actually get in there, that there's contemporary versions of, like, sirens and John Goodman as a cyclops and stuff. And there's the KKK lynch mob that's actually, you know, a reference through and stuff as well, and the bank robbing and stuff. It's incredibly well delivered by all the cast. I mean, the Coen brothers are known for taking in people who you recognise from other films and have a good history to them, but actually make an incredible use of them without them overshadowing anybody else that they're acting against. It just becomes an ensemble piece, and, you know, it's one of Clooney's best bits of work, in my opinion, as well as in order that he's not just playing a pretty boy, you know, that he sometimes gets lumped into. You know, it shows that if ever there was a question over his acting talent, there's, you know, it's there to be seen. You know, and supporting players from, like I said, John Goodman and Holly Hunter. Charles Durning is in it as well, playing himself, basically, playing the part he always plays. But, but yeah, it's just littered with, you know, with great moments, and the charm and the wit and the cleverness all linked together. It's what you expect from a Coen brothers film, but it's just there with aplomb, really, to just soak up and enjoy. You know, if you've never watched a Coen brothers film before, I mean, this is... You know, for one to start on, it's not in any way a difficult sell, I don't think.
No. What I like about the Coen brothers stuff is that you get this sort of comedy movie that they do with a slightly surreal twist to it. You know, you have to suspend a little bit of disbelief in this movie. But then, what was the black and white one they did a couple of years ago about the folk singer?
It was...
I want to say I, Daniel Blake, but it's Inside Llewellyn Davis.
Inside Llewellyn Davis.
That's it.
Yeah.
So you get that, which is a more serious sort of straight-laced narrative type story that they do. Or you get the romantic comedy like Intolerable Cruelty or something like that. Or Blood Simple, which is a pretty straight-laced tale, yeah. Miller's Crossing. But these ones, these slightly quirky ones like Hudsucker Proxy or Hail Caesar. No.
Yeah, and Big Lebowski.
Big Lebowski. And this stuff. Excellent. Yeah. You know, and you are spot on with George Clooney here. I mean, all three leads, John Turturro, Tim Blake Nelson as well. Fine. And the music, even if you don't like that slice of Americana, that bluegrass type music.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You'll be singing Man of Constant Sorrow by the end of this film, without a doubt.
Yeah, the way they integrate the music in there is, you know, astounding, really, I think, to just make it fit for the era and just sell the whole piece as being a piece in time. You know, you can believe it all, right down to the finest detail, I think, and that's one of the things that they do. They do a film that is beguiling in that it's a comedy, but it's actually got the detail in there to... to make it rewatchable and stand the test of time in a way. So
yeah, I can see a few people not liking it, but if you can get on board with it and know where you think this is going to go within the first 5 minutes, if you can actually think then it will hook you. And amazing, it's got, I'm just looking now, mate, it's got a 7.8 on IMDb, which is quite high. So
yeah, it's a very worthy film to recommend to people. As you say, the list that we're giving might not all be recommendations, they just happen to be films that fit the criteria. That is a recommendation from me, is Il Brivolo Art, though. So.
Okay, well, my number six might be a recommendation to some people. Oh, this was tough, but I'm going to include this. Going back to, we were talking about the golden age of TV. British TV, British sitcoms in the 70s. Jump forward a few years to the 80s, mate, and UK TV, a lot of people forget, we only had three channels, four in 1982. Yeah. So a lot of our programming was reliant on first run movies. You know, I always remember network premieres were a big deal back in the day. But also, we relied a lot on US imports from sitcoms like, say, Cheers, Taxi, MASH, whatever. That, you know, there's a lot of American imports. And one of the biggest things that British TV relied on was the American TV movie in the 80s, or the miniseries. You know, we had the Thornbirds and Shogun, Roots, golden age of that type of programme. The TV movie, probably more sort of synonymous with the Hallmark Channel nowadays, I suppose.
Yeah.
Or as I used to call it, Disease of the Week movie. Pinnacle of that genre was reached in 1983. You're not showing any signs of recognition so far, so I'm assuming you haven't seen it. It was a movie called Who Will Love My Children?
Oh.
Right, the mists of time are slowly clearing now.
It's
a bloody awful film because it's scarred into my brain tissue because my ex-wife had a copy of this on video and would watch it and bawl her eyes out at the end of it. For those that don't know, I mean, it's got a solid cast. You've got Frederick Forrest and Anne Margaret in the lead roles here. Okay. And Anne Margaret plays the mother of 10 children. Anne Margaret, I can't remember the exact details because I don't think I ever watched it all in one go.
Terminal illness of some sort, isn't it?
Yeah.
She's got.
So she's got this limited amount of time to farm out the kids, but no one's going to take 10 children all at once.
It's like puppies, isn't it?
It is. And she's going around, it's the story of her trying to get these kids palmed off. And the most heartbreaking one, I'm sure I remember this rightly, I swear there was twins and she couldn't get anybody to take the twins together, and it was the Sophie's Choice moment sort of thing. You know, I don't remember too much about it, but I've included it on the list mainly because it's got a question mark at the end of it, but also it's one of those eras of British TV and American TV that sadly has been superseded by big budget television now. Breaking Bads and Your House and stuff like that. And I, for one, am sorry to see it go, but I may go back and watch it at some point just to have a laugh.
I want to see it remade by the Coen brothers. Because that would be an absolutely brilliant film, I think.
Who Will Love My Children?
those melodramas where it was, like you say, Disease of the Week, or, you know, it's like it is.
Or it's always someone on death row or something as well.
Yeah, somebody who was widowed and the whole family was about to lose their entire, you know, the ranch or whatever. It was a staple of our free channel television in the 80s that me and you remember, and a lot of our podcasting friends don't remember because they're too young.
But yeah, I miss those days, mate, when we didn't have any choice. We had to watch these things. This is why TV programmes would get 26 million viewers like Morecambe and Wise at their peak, you know, because there was only two, three channels and you had nothing else to watch.
Yeah. And like me and you used to, you know, stay up until like 1 a.m. watch some kind of obscure film that wouldn't be shown at any other time.
Yep, that's where we go.
Just before closed down.
Yeah, before the national anthem. What the hell happened to that? You know, excellent stuff. Great memories. I spoke to a fellow podcaster today, Mark, who's part of the Good, the Bad and the Odd podcast, and he's a similar age to us. And some of our fondest memories are the horror double bills that the BBC used to show. I mean, we've had this conversation before, I believe, haven't we, mate, about those? You know, we were probably only about 7, 8, 9 years old, but it's formative times for your movie watching, and it's influenced my movie watching from that day. And unfortunately, probably so as who will love my bloody children.
Yeah, I mean, I referenced it on the last episode of this show when I, with Booze, about yourself and me both with this habit of having watched these films at a younger age in the early 80s when that was your only option to actually catch these things at obscure times on, and when BBC Two was the go-to place to watch avant-garde cinema.
Yeah.
Right, so my next one is Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
Ah, now that's on my list.
Great. Robert Aldrich, who also directed Dirty Dozen, amongst other films, didn't he? I think he did get into a series of doing a few of these more sort of, what did they call it? Hag horror.
Hag horror. I've never heard it called that before.
Sort of films. But yeah, starring Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, along with Victor Buono and Mady Norman.
Yes.
Obviously, it's a classic of melodrama. It's quite well known. Not everybody has seen it, unfortunately. Unfortunately, but it's it really did create a genre, I think. But the intensity in it, you can tell that there was more to it than just the characters on screen not getting on. There's a history of attrition between the two leads off screen as well, as we know, which is quite well documented.
Yes.
In fact, there's a TV series that's just come out called Feud,
yes.
Which has got Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon in it, who do magnificent performances, actually portraying the behind-the-scenes creation of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and really does flesh out when you watch the film, knowing what went on in the background and their rivalry leading up to this, and how it was a sort of a forced thing where they decided to actually do this film together in order to still have a career, the pair of them, when they were both on their uppers, really.
Yeah.
Just an outline of the plot for anybody who hasn't seen it, and who might be able to persuade to see it, which with our description, possibly not.
Probably not.
It's about two aging sisters from the old days of cinema, who one was a starlet from youth, the Baby Jane of the title,
mm-hmm.
and her older sister who got stardom in her adult life, and their rivalry despite being forced to remain together due to one of them having a crippling car accident, and this psychodrama of them, Baby Jane basically bullying and holding her older sister hostage in order to be her carer but also her torturer. And as the various psychological elements fall away and the bits of the past come out and the realisation of what's always been the case is no longer the case as far as their lives, it is quite dramatic, and the performances, although they're quite overwrought in some senses, they actually play well within the context of the film. So I think it is a great example of the genre and a true classic, really.
Didn't realise it was a genre.
Well, yes, yeah. It seems like the, what else have I heard it described as? There's hag horror and there's the psycho bitch genre as well, I think. There's a couple of different ones that have been attached to it. And I know that, as I say, Robert Aldrich did a couple of films following on from it, which I think were people trying to plough the same water but without the same success at all, because this was a successful novel before it was became a film. So I think it already had the pedigree. And once this has been done, it's very hard to follow up with something that doesn't just seem like a pale imitation. Intense performances, definitely, and you know, from the two leads, who in their heyday were very much sought after actresses, and you know, as this turns out, it's aging actresses portraying aging actresses, who have a bitter rivalry, and you know, it's art imitating life, really.
Well, so. In one of the only bits of research that I've done for this podcast, I watched this last night. Hadn't seen it for a long time. And you saying about aging actresses in sort of like the twilights of their career, this was made, what was it, 62, right? So you can imagine Crawford and Davis were at their peak 20 years previously, in the 40s, say. That was probably about their heyday. And Davis would go on for another 20 years. She was still acting in the early 80s, from what I can remember, wasn't she? Can you imagine? I'm not saying like recast the movie or remake the movie, but take a similar situation today, right? So we're 2017. And go back 20 years to an actress or set of actresses that had their heyday, late 1990s, early 2000s, right? So I'm thinking Sharon Stone, Michelle Pfeiffer, Gina Davis, that sort of era. And then casting them in a movie 20 years on, i.e. today. I don't think it would work, because I don't know, because there is this hag element, as you've described it. I cannot see Sharon Stone, Gina Davis, Michelle Pfeiffer portraying hag-like characters. because they're still pretty glamorous after, you know, after the 20 years have passed, which is the similar time scale to this. It just intrigued me. It's a great movie. I love it. I love the whole premise of it. And to see two of the titans of the silver screen, the golden age of Hollywood era, back together, not wanting to be together, if you know the backstory.
Yeah.
It just makes it even more fascinating, because some of the things that Bette Davis does to Joan Crawford, you just get this sense that she's relishing every bloody minute of it in real life. And it's great. It is a fantastic film. And as I say, I watched it last night for the first time in about 15, 20 years, and it still holds true, mate. It is still a bloody good watch.
It was same for me. I mean, I hadn't watched it for a similar amount of time. And actually watching it a few weeks ago for this purpose. And then, you know, having already started to, I think I watched the first episode of Feud before I actually rewatched it. I thought, no, I must do it the right way around, watch the film first.
Yeah.
And the details that are in that are already documented in the trivia for the actual, in IMDb for it, about, you know, the things they did just to sort of snipe at each other on set. And how Bette Davis's, the wig that she wears, yeah, is a wig from a film that Joan Crawford did like 20 years previous, and that, you know, she failed to win an Oscar for, sort of thing. And it's just like just stabbing the way at each other, you know. And it ties into the actual film and adds an extra ingredient into it, because it's not just acting from two people who were good actresses, but this extra element, like you say. I can't actually argue with you all about the update. What you would have, because for all that there's still massive misogyny in the Hollywood business at the moment, it's nowhere as near as bad as it was, where as soon as a woman's looks went, they were written off. They've got more longevity nowadays than they did back then. You'd have to probably lengthen it to some people who were 30 or 40 years down the line. But even then, it'd be a bit of a struggle to capture the same dynamic of them being left on the shelf in the same way and then being at their worst ebb.
Yeah, I mean, say like Susan Sarandon, he's probably older than Bette Davis and Joan Crawford was now.
Yeah.
You know, when they made this movie. Still a glamorous woman, and still, you know, she's playing grandmothers now, but she's no way a Jessica Tandy type, you know. It's not got to that point, you know. They couldn't remake this movie with the actresses that are about nowadays, or those that are about 20 years previously, which is the point I was trying to get to.
Absolutely, yeah, you're right. It wouldn't be feasible to catch the same dynamic and the same feeling. I mean, you'd have to set it back then anyway, because the reality wouldn't actually fit with how things are nowadays. But you'd struggle to find the actresses that would actually fit in the same way.
Absolutely. As I was saying, not actually do a remake of the movie, but that the whole premise
dynamic,
of
yeah.
that whole premise yeah, yeah. of, you know, somebody from 20 years ago making a comeback in the twilight of their career, and it just wouldn't work in the way that this does. But yeah, it holds up immensely. If you are interested, there's a fantastic book that Feud is probably based on. I can't remember the name of the author, but it's called Betty and Joan: The Divine Feud. Which I've got a copy of, and it is really good insight into the whole feud. It is really good.
I'm reasonably sure that is what the actual TV series is based on. To be honest, I think you've hit it directly then. So you've read the source material for, you know, that I'm lazily just watching instead of reading. So.
Number five.
Yes, please.
Number five. Okay, I'm going to take the first of my liberties here. It has got a question mark in the title. Originally, looking through a list of potential candidates for this list, I was going to include What's Up, Doc, which is...
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, Ryan O'Neill,
yeah.
Barbara Streisand.
I actually watched that in order to consider for this this show, but it didn't make it to my list, though.
Ah, right, okay. Well, we could probably talk about that as also Rans later, possibly, because that's a great example of a modern remake of a screwball comedy. Instead, it's the shortest movie on my list, and it might not officially count as a movie, but it's been screened in cinemas way back in the 50s. It's Bugs Bunny in What's Opera, Doc? One of the greatest Elmer Fudd Bugs Bunny collaborations from Chuck Jones, 1957, quite a late one, and it takes a different twist. You must have seen it again.
Looney Tunes
cartoons were a staple of the scheduling on Saturday afternoons after Grandstand or whatever. You know, it starts off with this booming thunder and lightning, and it's sort of set as a Wagnerian opera, and you see this huge silhouette of this towering Viking with a horned helmet, and then the camera zooms in and it's Elmer Fudd, who's literally only 4 foot tall or whatever he is.
Yeah.
And the whole cartoon is sung rather than spoken. It's about 6 or 7 minutes long. You've got Bugs Bunny as like a Grunhilde type character with the blonde pigtails riding this really fat horse. You've got thunder and lightning and big booming orchestras. And surprisingly, it's one of only 3 Elmer Fudd Bugs Bunny cartoons where Elmer Fudd gets the better of Bugs.
Right.
And I just wanted to include it because it was just a little bit different and a little bit quirky.
No, I do remember it, yes. And like you say, it has been shown in cinemas. So it does have that to try and help push it forward as a viable option.
But thank you.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the animation is, you know, superbly done in the sense of some other films that have been done animated, but the actual making it work with the actual characters they've got and putting them into that situation.
Yeah.
It's something that was, you know, ahead of its time, really, to actually adapt existing characters and put them into what is opera.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that was quite a brave and innovative thing to do at the time. So
bit of a niche,
deserves notice for that.
Bit of a niche sort of market, but it works. I mean, just to sort of give it some sort of gravitas as well, I've just noticed here, in 1994, 1,000 members of the animation industry ranked What's Opera Doc first in a list of the 50 greatest cartoons of all time. So there's some sort of
pedigree, isn't it?
Yeah. So again, I just wanted to include that, because the list is quite small what we could select from, but it was just something a little bit different I wanted to pop in there. So
happily so. Yeah. Right. My next one is, who is Harry Kellerman and why is he saying those awful things about me?
I saw that on the list. Please tell me about it.
It's directed by Ulu Gospard, which I've never heard of them before. They did a lot of Broadway work, and I think this was actually inspired by some theatrical writing rather than being film writing as such. Starring Dustin Hoffman, who obviously we universally recognise as being a fantastic actor. It's also got Jack Warden, Rose Ugario, and Barbara Harris in it. I suppose the question for people out there is if they like films about Dylan-esque pop musicians in an existential crisis, because this is basically what this film is. It's variably described as by people as being either a mess or actually innovative. I don't suppose the two things are necessarily mutually exclusive, but in our film watching experience.
Yeah.
But it does try to do a lot more with the flashbacks and the referencing to what could be going on without actually showing what's going on in that sense. The lead character, which is Dustin Hoffman, cross between Burt Bacharach and Bob Dylan, at that high, sort of height of level of fame and notoriety and money. But, you know, he's obviously not very satisfied in his life and he's questioning things, and he's got this preoccupation and obsession that he's not finding love because of the fact that there's this guy called Harry Kellerman who's going around telling all the girls that starts to get involved with that he's various lies about him as far as he's concerned, that he's got a string of women, that he treats them badly, that he's got ex-wife and children and all, you know, all these kind of things. And as the film plays out, you can see that these things that are allegedly being said about him are true. you know, at a certain point you actually discover who Harry Kellerman is. And it's probably not too much of a spoiler to upset things for people who might watch it, but it has a certain forerunning of Fight Club about it, in my sense. And if I don't say any more than that, then some people will get what I mean and some people won't.
Yeah.
It is quite experimental in some ways in which it's shot and the dialogue of it. And it's not a big action budget with lots of explosions or anything like that going on. It's basically following Dustin Hoffman all the time. He's in pretty much every shot. And the kind of struggles that he's having mentally with assimilating himself to actually be happy in a world where he's actually quite successful and should be quite happy in a lot of terms, but obviously can't be. And the reasons why he can't be Oscar are there to be seen as it plays out. So it's not got a very high rating on IMDb, I seem to recall. And I think the rating of it entirely depends upon when you actually see it and what you're looking for in a film. You could actually, you know, get a lot out of it if you're in the right mood and you're the right person, but other people will just find it to be nonsense, I think. So it depends on which way, you know, where you are, whether you find it an intriguing experiment in film and a forerunner of other things and how it plays out, or whether it's just don't go anywhere for you. So it does have a question mark at the end, so it counts.
I must admit, it's one of the Dustin Hoffmans that I haven't seen and pretty much unaware of. And just looking on IMDb at Ulu Grosbard, who was the director, he was a Belgian director. Yeah. And he only made 7 movies, 2 of which had Robert De Niro in, True Confessions and Falling in Love. And he also did, there's one called Straight Time, which I think was Dustin Hoffman again, which I've seen before. It sounds interesting, mate. I think I'm going to have to check that one out just to make my own mind up, because that is just, it's one of those gaps in me Hoffman filmography that I need to plug.
Yeah, because I would be very interested to hear your opinion of it, because I think that you'd give it the chance that it deserves and sort of see through maybe some of the superficial critique that some people may have of it.
But yeah,
that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll come out the other side giving it a glowing review. So I'd be interested in your review of it, to be honest. So maybe as one of your films that you've watched as an extra sort of thing in between, you know, at the beginning of Stinking Paws, you can just give a brief synopsis of your viewing of it to Charlie sometime in the far future.
I probably will, because one thing Charlie always says about me is that, similar to what you've just said, I try to see the good in most movies, because I know for a fact that I couldn't do what these people do. I could not make a movie. I couldn't direct a movie. I couldn't act in a movie. I couldn't script write a movie. So I fully respect all the effort that goes into movie making, and I give every film I watch a fair chance.
Even San Andreas.
San Andreas, movie of the year 2 years ago. I will stand by that. No, that one is, again, I always stand my corner on San Andreas, because, as I said, it set out to do exactly what I wanted it to do, and that was
exactly
to entertain.
What it said in the tin.
Exactly, yeah. I wanted to be entertained for 2 hours, and I just switched my brain off, and it gave me that film. It was and it was an unexpected surprise. It was an unexpected pleasure as well. I wasn't expecting too much of it, and I do love that film. But this, I will certainly go on your recommendation, mate, because you are very rarely wrong. So yes.
Well, thank you. I'll look forward to hearing what your review of that is. Yeah. So, what's next for you to tell me about?
My number 4, as we go backwards from 7, we've both chosen Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which I did have at number 1. But number 4, as the rules of grammar are dictating where we go in this particular list, and any film that has not got a question mark is not permitted, okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the other end of the scale and give you the title of a film, which is just a question mark.
Ah.
Okay? You're quite a big fan, because we've had you as a guest on our show reviewing The Stranger with Orson Welles.
Yes.
So
yes.
I know you like Mr. Welles and his body of work.
Yeah.
You would have heard of this. Whether you've watched it or not, I'll have to find out. Go back to 1973. It was possibly the last full-length feature that Welles was involved in, and it was a documentary called F for Fake. It got a bit of a cinema release last year. I think what they did was they remastered it, and I think Criterion brought out this all-singing, all-dancing version of it. It's a quirky little oddity because it's a documentary, which you don't usually associate with Welles, but also the subject matter is quite, well, not unique, but it stretches over a couple of different sort of subjects. Welles himself describes it as an examination of trickery, fraud and lies. And the focus of the story, there's a guy who's a professional art forger, world famous at the time. I can't think of his name, Emile de Hoy or something like that.
Right.
And it's an investigation of his work and how he tricked the world with his art forgeries. But then it intertwines with other famous sort of like deceptions. And Welles touches upon his most famous deception, which was 1938's War of the Worlds.
Yeah, I seem that's the bit that seems to be ringing a bell with me.
Yeah.
Whether I've seen the whole thing or whether it's just somehow linked to other discussion or other documentaries about that. Carry on, yeah.
But then there's also, The whole way the film's shot is really good as well. It's a masterclass in cutting and panning and, you know, lots of different movie techniques that you expect from Wells. He takes quite centre stage as narrator and sort of interviewer in a lot of the sequences. Uses the opportunity, as I say, to bring in the War of the Worlds story as well. But then there's also this twist within the twist that there was something about the biographer of the guy that was the art forger was also involved in a deception because he'd written a false biography about Howard Hughes.
That was, yeah, Howard Hughes, that's it, yeah.
You're ringing a bell now.
It is ringing a bell, yeah, yeah.
And it all sort of intertwines and it just becomes this real great sort of like mystery itself, you know. It's a unique piece of work. It's certainly not your Citizen Kane or your Magnificent Ambersons or The Stranger, but it's great because it's the last great piece of work that Wells did before he became this drunken port swilling, you know, parody of himself that would only go on to appear in like the Muppet movie and things like that from after this. And it just goes to prove that the man was a bloody genius. I mean, we had this conversation when you joined our show, yeah, mate, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. He was, and obviously had the ego to match.
Yeah.
But the only time I think things that he did faltered were because of his own tinkering with it and his own self-sabotage, really. Otherwise, you know, things he touched when he actually went for it and allowed it to be what it should be, they were just masterpieces, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm including that because its original title is F for Fake, but at some point it was released just under the title of ? Just as a bit of intrigue. So I'm hoping you're going to allow me that one to go through.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's something to do with Picasso as well, isn't it?
Possibly. I can't remember. I saw it a couple of years ago. It's just fascinating, mate. There's twists upon things, you know, about this biographer, the art forger, Wells' own deception. He intercuts with things like bits of magic and stuff like that, the art sleight of hand. And, you know, it's a big subject to cover, but he does it in a really clever way.
Wow, yeah. I'll have to sort of maybe revisit that because it does ring a bell. Not in any solid way. It's just tickling at the edge of my memory rather than anything concrete.
I'm going to rewatch it because, as I say, there's this great Blu-ray transfer of it now available, so it might be worth investing and having another little look at it.
Good stuff. Yeah, it's another one from the left field,
yeah,
as it were. Well, going a lot more mainstream with mine, my next one is What About Bob?
I haven't seen that since it came out.
No, I kind of figured you would have seen it at some point, and probably when it first came out.
Yeah.
So it's Frank Oz, who obviously we all know well from the Muppets with Orson Welles.
yeah, starring Orson Welles, yeah.
Orson Welles. But, you know, obviously a puppeteer and voice actor and things, as well as a director, things like... he did Little Shop of Horrors, I think, and he definitely did Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yes.
And he kind of, you know, did a number of sort of comedies in the mid to late 80s and early 90s that were of a similar ilk, and they were fairly sort of predictable, pedestrian sort of plots, really, in a number of ways, but usually lifted by having some of the comic talent of the time to deliver some witticisms in a script that lifted it from just being sort of completely throwaway. And in this case, they've got Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss and Julie Haggerty starring in it. So, basic plot, psychiatrist who's a rising star as far as within his own profession and becoming a bit more of a pop phenomenon, getting professional acclaim. He's just about to embark upon that side of his career when a newly entrusted to him patient ends up becoming obsessively needy and ultimately interlopes into his family vacation. And obviously what predictably plays out is the way in which the patient, played by Bill Murray, manages to integrate himself with the family, and his mental health and obsessions improve as the psychiatrist, played by Richard Dreyfuss, has his own mental stability breaks down in sort of parallel. So one's going up and the other one's going down. And, you know, there's, you know, great performances as you expect from Bill Murray, who just does what Bill Murray does. But apparently, again, harking back to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, there was tensions on set because the two of them had a number of run-ins because of their different way of working. And I think Bill Murray generally did actually drive Richard Dreyfuss completely insane with the way that he was actually ad-libbing and messing about between things and practical jokes and things. So that sort of adds to the tension that you can actually see revealing in the film, where he's slowly losing it is the character, and that you get the impression that Richard Dreyfuss is doing so as well. So, but it's a good comedy from that era. It's one that you, as you said before, you don't expect too much from, and if you... You know, watching it just for the joy of just watching something, then it does exactly the job that it says on the tin.
I was going to say, is it a good film? Because I can't remember anything about that movie. That's become lost in the mists of all those touchstone comedies that were about that sort of time, you know, with Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin and Danny DeVito, and it was round about all of that sort of era.
Oh, yeah, it's very much within that set of films, absolutely, and fits completely set bang in the middle of them. But, you know, the leads perform it well, and the writing's good enough to hold up and not be complete tosh, and it gets away with it rather than it being making it a classic film or even a classic comedy. But it's a worthwhile watch if, you know, it's one of those films that is, you happen upon it on a bank holiday Monday afternoon and you're just feeling settled after having a big lunch or something, and you just watch it, and it does exactly the job that you want it to do. So it's not terrible, but it's on the good side of those touchstone comedies, I'd say.
Cool. I'm going to go and rediscover that one then, because honestly, I don't remember anything about that at all. But one thing I do know, I mean, big fan of Bill Murray, Richard Dreyfuss, as you call him. And Frank Oz, Dirty Rotten Scoundrel, is one of my favourite comedies. So, yeah, got to go back and have a little look at that, I think.
Yeah, give it a go, yeah. And, you know, obviously there'll be the upset coming along soon at some point with the remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Is there?
Which I think is unnecessary. Yeah, yeah.
It's not going to be a musical version, is it, like they did with the producers? Because I know there's a stage musical version
of
it at the moment.
No, it's more along the lines of the Ghostbusters aspect.
Oh, no. Okay. But then again, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is a remake of a French movie, wasn't it, I believe?
Exactly, so, yeah. Yes. So it won't have, no,
yeah,
so,
we can't complain.
So a remake of a remake, yeah. You know, fair enough. And some people will get some out of it, like they did with Ghostbusters remake, yeah. And other people will decide to just not bother. And each to their own. So
exactly.
There's enough out there for everybody, I think, is the case. So,
who are we?
So yes, yeah. So who are we in our wisdom and experience with films and our ability to critique? To criticise.
Exactly.
Oh yeah, that's our point. So okay. Your next one
was an easy one for me. 1937. It's the seventh film to star Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Shall We Dance?
Ah, no, I looked at that, but I didn't get a copy to watch, so it stayed off my list just because I hadn't watched it. So
okay.
you fire away with your review, because I'll be interested to see how it pans out.
Okay, not my favourite of the Astaire's Rogers pairing. Top Hat, I think, is still my favourite of those two together. But this one is really good in the sense that it's the first one to feature music and lyrics by George and Ira Gershwin.
Oh, right.
So, along with the plot that features, if I remember rightly, something to do with a ballet company. So, as well as your usual Fred and Ginger dance numbers and your tap dancing routines, you get a few ballet sequences, but then the Gershwin music is just divine in it. You know, it's great. It's perfectly suited for all of the musical sequences. You've got some real great sort of comic backup from Edward Everett Horton, who was a bit of a stalwart in that era, as you know, the comic foil in a lot of these sorts of movies. Fantastic character actor of the time. And if I just rattle off just three or four of the musical numbers, I mean, they are famously Gershwin numbers, but in this movie you get They All Laughed, Ginger Rogers singing They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus, which is great. Let's call the whole thing off. They can't take that away from me.
Wow.
And then the finale is Shall We Dance, when you get Fred in full top hat, white tie and tails, you know, the classic Fred Astaire. Very nearly didn't make it on the list, because in some places it hasn't got a question mark.
Right.
So I looked into this because I thought, okay, if you're going to start picking me up on this, I better have a bloody answer here. And the answer is Vincente Minnelli, Liza's dad,
yeah,
was a friend of the Gershwins. big friend of the Gershwins. They worked together quite a lot. And he suggested the title Shall We Dance with the question mark. It was him that suggested the title because they wanted to call the film something else completely different. I can't remember what it was. But for some reason, over the mists of time, it subsequently disappeared. And if you look at posters at the time and sort of subsequently, it hasn't got a question mark on it. But I remember seeing it online somewhere with a question mark, so I included it.
Well, I know there were some films that I looked into and found out that if you watched it in like Uzbekistan, the translation of it did actually add a question mark to it.
Right.
Because the grammar works differently over there. Obviously. Okay. Like Charlie might have been pointing out. But one of the films I looked at, and it did in its original format. It was an older film, like you say, back from the 30s. It's not one that I actually ended up on my list to talk about, but it did have a question mark originally, and then majority of the artwork that was released since didn't have a question mark on for some reason. And it's just one of these repeated errors. But when you actually look at its original release title, it did actually have it. So no, I'm happy to let you off with that one without it being in any way scrutiny.
Thank you very much.
So that qualifies. And obviously classic lineup there for the film. Oh, and as far as musicals go, I mean, they are the peak pairing, really, aren't they?
Yeah, Astaire's one of my movie heroes. Always has been. And, you know, it sounds a bit soppy, but I just regret never learning the tap dance, mate, because, you know, that is just to watch that man on screen. And, you know, you see people like Michael Jackson saying he was a massive influence and things like that. You don't see that sort of dancing anymore. It's all this, oh, what's the diversity or whatever, you know, it's all this big group sort of, like, you know, and the man.
Acrobatic dancing.
This is the film where he tap dances on roller skates.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And now that I do remember.
Yeah.
My mother is a massive fan, Fred Astaire. And along we've been subjected to massive amounts of Cliff Richard when I was a kid, which is falls into a category of child cruelty, in my opinion. When she, you know, apart from watching things like Summer Holiday and the Cliff Richard films, the only other films really I remember my mother watching while she was doing some baking or whatever, it was like Fred Astaire films and Ginger Rogers. So... And I saw the vast majority, I think, of them when I was a kid without actually obviously appreciating them.
Yeah.
And although I'm not, I still don't have a very good relationship with musicals, I can actually recognise that as far as the quality goes, that it's right up there at the top and deserves to be recommended and respected.
He's the talent
was just mystifying. Yeah, it really is.
Very, very important part of Hollywood history, mate. Very important, as far as I'm concerned.
So you think you couldn't take up tap dancing now, then?
No.
Think it's too late?
No, not with my knees, mate, no. I keep falling in the sink. Boom, boom.
Yeah. Hey! Oh, you're such a drip.
Hey, your turn.
Right, we'll go for something a bit serious again.
Okay.
Just to balance out a bit. And this is one that I wouldn't be surprised if it was on your list.
Mm-hmm.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Right. Now, I didn't include that for the reason being that I thought you would. So I tried to get as many titles in as possible. So, yeah, I'm going to let you have that one.
Right. Well, this film mainly depends upon whether people like watching drunk couples being passive-aggressive and actively aggressive. It's Mike Nichols, who directed it, who's obviously famous for a number of great films, including The Graduate and Catch-22 and Working Girl and Postcards from the Edge and stuff.
Yeah.
Starring the legends that are Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, along with George Segal and Sandy Dennis. It's obviously a theatre piece that's transferred to film. You can very much tell that, as we have commented before about other films, that you can see that the heavy dialogue, low effects, the minimal number of cast and scene locations, it just... you know, shows that something's just something that's come off the stage and been filmed, basically. And this is very much the dialogue and the backbiting relationship with these couples as they're getting increasingly drunk and increasingly vitriolic towards each other, and the waning and waxing of the aggression from passive to active and back again. It's just outstanding performances, and it's you know, not an easy watch because of the attention needed for a lot of the dialogue, that's where the plot comes from. But it's astounding in so many ways, in my opinion. The only thing is that, for some reason, when I sat down to watch it again, and I have seen it years ago, I sat down and it started up, and for some bizarre reason, I thought when I'd watched it before, it was in colour.
Ah.
And I don't know why, and it's, you know...
No, what's
I'm
the
not
other?
Sure, it's not a colorised version or anything. What's so the, I don't know where that came from.
What's the Tennessee Williams one with Elizabeth Taylor? Oh, is that one? I always get that one mixed up with. Is it Paul Newman?
That might be it then. Yeah,
is that the one? Streetcar Named Desire. Is that it?
Yes. Yeah.
That, I always got them mixed up. Or Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, possibly. I'm thinking of. They all seem to about that era all seem to be the moulding into one as such. I haven't seen.
I imagine this was done on a strict budget, and the stars were where the money went, and they kept everything else as simple as possible. So the black and white was obviously they could have had colour, but decided not to because of wanting to figuring it wasn't going to be a commercial success in the way of some of the other films that were released in the mid '60s. But
66
performances.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. It's one of those ones I haven't seen for 20-odd years again, mate. But one thing I do remember is it is just this concentration. I think it's only four characters, isn't there, I believe, in the whole thing.
There are two. This is the thing. It's got two people who are very much bit parts that actually don't need to be there, really.
Yeah.
When they go to a bar and they go in and it's deserted, and they have at least 5, nearly 10 minutes in this bar just... Mm. Sort of doing what they're liking it before the guy, the proprietor, sort of comes out and just speaks one line to him, and you see just the sort of back of his head as he's talking to him, and then it disappears again, and then his wife comes in and hands out some glasses of drink, but neither of them really need to be there, so they could have actually hived it down even more to just the four characters, because that's definitely where it's coming from. You can understand that in the play they probably just had some stage hands do those roles of the barkeep.
I don't even know if they're in the stage production. I think it might have been the four main characters, mate. And am I right in thinking that a lot of the conversation revolves around the sun that we don't see as well?
Yes, very much so.
X-rated as well. It was one of the first X-rated sort of mainstream movies, if I remember rightly. Mike Nichols, fantastic director. We lost him quite recently, didn't we, I believe?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
And the play, Edward Albee, I've just had to look that up. I'm not that knowledgeable, mate. Edward Albee wrote the play. But the screenplay is Ernest Lehman. Now, Charlie and I were discussing Ernest Lehman a couple of weeks back on the show because he was scriptwriter for Sweet Smell of Success with Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster.
Oh, yeah.
But also, he was the screenwriter for, get this, North by Northwest, The Sound of Music, West Side Story, Hello Dolly. The man was incredible. He had a real incredible CV.
What an underachiever, eh?
Yeah, he should have done a little bit more, really. But it just proves that when you've got a good source material, but then it's adapted by possibly the greatest screenwriter at the time, and then you've got two of the biggest stars at the time. I mean, Elizabeth Taylor was just coming off the back of that debacle that was Cleopatra 2-3 years earlier. And she was going into these mature roles. Butterfield 8, I think, was a few years before that. She won the Oscar for that. But incredible. I love this period of Elizabeth Taylor. I think it's her most accomplished period. It's her most interesting period of work. It's her most adult period of work as well.
I agree. I think it's where she's grown into herself as an actress. I mean, her earlier roles, yes, there was the talent there in it, but it was very much more focused on her looks and her acting talent being secondary to it, whereas this was where she actually managed to show that she had the acting talent and was considered to be, you know, somebody with skill and proficiency, really.
As I say, George Segal, very early role for George Segal, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely,
as well.
Must be.
Great film. Again, this list of things that I've got to rewatch is getting longer and longer.
Well, hope to influence some of the listeners to actually, you know, go and watch some of these films. I didn't expect to be creating a list for you to actually go away and watch, but, you know, it's great that they are films that, I mean, I've had same experience as you. Yeah. A number of these films were ones that I've seen 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of a time to rewatch them and stuff and sort of reappraise them, because I've said before, films that I watched 20 years ago, there's no way I appreciated them properly.
No.
You know, so now being able to go back to them and properly appreciate and give them the serious consideration they deserve for not just what's on screen, but actually recognising, like you said, that the script writing and such like, it's what they deserve.
Yeah, you have to. We said, I think, when you was on our show before, anything you watch prior to the age of 16 or 18 doesn't count. You have to rewatch it with adult eyes, because there's loads of movies that I watched far too young. Brilliant.
The majority of what we were saying about the stuff watching on BBC Two at late nights and stuff, majority of that was before I was 18.
Yeah.
And so I can say I've seen it, but I can't feel like I've actually seen it, you know.
Yeah. Exactly, and it's certainly worth going back. And you've rekindled a lot of memories with a lot of these titles today, so I'm going to go back and certainly watching that again, that's for sure.
Good, good. So let's see if you can do the same with your next.
Right, well, this is going to be my last because we doubled up on Baby Jane. I watched this in Uzbekistan where it had a question mark at the end of it. Because, unfortunately, this hasn't, and I thought it had.
Yeah.
I did reveal it to you because you scuppered this plan right at the beginning. It's the Tina Turner biopic, What's Love Got to Do with It? Again, I probably only included this because it's one of the ones that I've actually seen, but I saw it back in 93 when it first came out. To my mind, we've had some great music biopics. We've had Ray, we've had Walk the Line. There's that Nina Simone one that came out last year. Fairly good, you know. But what sets this one apart, I think, from those, it's done with the full cooperation of Tina Turner herself. It was based on her autobiography, Itina, I believe it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And she even appears at the end, doesn't she, in a short sequence in a concert or something like that. So you know that it's got the full Tina Turner stamp of approval. To add to that, you've got a career-defining performance for Angela Bassett. She's never been better.
No, absolutely true. I mean, she did have, like you said, Tina Turner's involvement herself in it. Mm. Meant that she was actually directly coaching and speaking to and supporting Angela Bassett to get everything right, all the signature moves and everything. She does nail it, absolutely. It's not just somebody doing a play all, you know, she does actually carry it off to Tina's satisfaction. You know, she'd be the one to actually judge it properly. So I absolutely agree there where you're coming from.
And although he's not billed as a villain in the classic sense of a villain, Lawrence Fishburne is a bastard in this film.
Well, I mean, Ike Turner was it's a sounding piece of work for it to be done in cooperation, like you say, with the actual subject of it, which many of them are, because you know they're done sometimes after people have died.
Exactly.
But I mean, it profiles the intensity of that explosive relationship, and it absolutely shows the struggle that poor woman had in an era when she wasn't just battling against having an abusive husband, but she was also battling against the idea of there being a woman who, you know, she was still, when women's rights were still being pursued, and also being a black woman as well. And the combination of all the factors, and that she did actually persevere and did actually succeed and become one of the biggest stars of, well, the 80s in the end.
Yeah.
It just shows her tenacity and her talent as well.
Exactly. It's a great story if you don't know the Tina Turner story. Mm. You know, you're just familiar with the music. And I think I read somewhere Whitney Houston was offered the role.
Mm.
But I think she fell pregnant just before filming was due to start. And prior to Angela Bassett taking the role, Fishburne had turned it down 5 times. And then when he heard that Angela Bassett was on board, he snapped it up straight away.
Well done for him.
Yeah.
Because I don't think Whitney Houston would have done a good job of it.
No, I honestly don't.
And it's pretty much exemplary of what a sort of biography of a musical figure should be.
Yeah.
The source material is great and everything. I have dipped into the source material, and I think the only thing that I felt was missing from the film was that it's a point of a fact that she recognises herself, that when she was at her lowest ebb and she gone solo and she was just singing in bars and clubs.
Yes.
It was David Bowie who dragged down some executives from the record label and said, "You've got to see this. This is the genuine article." And they saw and he said, "You need to sign her up." And they did do. And she recognises that, you know, he was instrumental in keeping her career alive in that sense. And as a David Bowie fan, you know, thinking, why didn't they give him the recognition?
But
he probably didn't want it because that's not what he did it for. But
no. You've just explained something there for me. On Tina Turner's comeback album, that one she released mid-80s, the one with What's Love Got to Do with It on it, and Private Dancer, I think it was called Private Dancer, wasn't it? She does a version of 1984 from Diamond Dogs.
Ah, yes.
So that is probably her thank you to him. There you go.
They did do a duet at one point as well.
They did.
It was terrible, but still. But yeah, absolutely a fantastic film without a shadow of a doubt.
And that's a worthy watch
for anybody.
That has snuck in despite your strict grammar regulations.
I'll have to beat you up later about it in some form, or make you pay some kind of penalty.
Okie doke.
So, right, well, my next one, and final two, see if this is one that will actually encourage you to go and do a watch and add it to your list. It's called Who Am I?
Who Am I?
Yeah. Now, it's done in 1998.
Yeah.
Directed by Benny Chan.
Okay.
Starring Jackie Chan and... Who gives a fuck who else is it, to be honest? I mean, do you like finely choreographed fight scenes and slapstick comedy wrapped up in a paper-thin plot? If you do, this is the film for
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Okay.
Jackie Chan, just that's what it is. I mean, it's never anything of any real meat in the plot. I have to admit that much. And there was New Police Story, which we've discussed on previous episodes of History Misunderstanding, which actually showed Jackie Chan acting, which is not something he often needs to do in a film, but it is. I mean, Jackie Chan's just Jackie Chan, and it's about the chop socky action and the slapstickness of all this action. So he never tried to be a serious martial artist in films. He wanted to actually have the comedy as well, because a bigger influence on his career was like Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin than Bruce Lee was. So as a vehicle for him to do that kind of slapstick comedy in a sort of thinly plotted action film, this is the vehicle. The plot basically is that he's a special operative in some military unit and gets double-crossed, and the whole team gets wiped out, but he actually manages to survive, but with amnesia. So hence the Who Am I?
Oh, right. Makes sense.
And then he's on the quest to try and find out what his actual name is. He's got various people from the CIA and other governmental agencies sort of trying to gain his trust in order to lure him into traps where they can actually finally finish him off, but some he can trust, some he can't, and it's just, there's a very run-of-the-mill plot in the background there. And it's dubbed English because it's originally in Mandarin or Cantonese.
Oh, right, I was going to say it's an English language one.
So it's got the English language over the top, and so the lip-syncing is, again, a point of amusement. Although, strangely enough, plot actually does work better in English, because they managed to make a joke out of the fact that because he can't remember who he is or his name, he takes on the name Who Am I? Which obviously works a lot better with various sort of Chinese people who are called Who and When. So they actually play upon that at a couple of points, and you're thinking, well, that wouldn't have actually worked in Chinese.
Yeah.
So somebody's actually thought about that ahead when they've actually been writing the original script, thinking, when I do the English translation, that's going to be funny. But yeah, it's got some amazing stunts in it, as you would expect from Jackie Chan, and some amazing fight sequences that are choreographed to the hilt. The choreography on some of the finest Jackie Chan fight sequences is bordering on some of the choreography of some of the finest dance scenes in musicals. So it's just what he does and does well, and it doesn't bamboozle you with a great amount of plot to try and figure out. It just plays out in front of you, one scene to the next, one action sequence to the next, with some vague linking between the two, from him jumping off a skyscraper onto some sloping glass base that's gone all the way side down the building, or having a fight in Amsterdam where he's basically kicking clogs at people. it's all there for you to enjoy, just as a complete chewing gum for your eyes, really. So, which will probably hurt. So there you go.
It's another one on my list.
That's one on
the
list,
is it? I'm more familiar with the Hollywood Jackie Chan.
Rush Hour and Shanghai Nights.
I saw Police Story when it first came out, and a few of the earlier ones, you know, and then sort of lost touch with him in between, and some of the new stuff as well, you know, when he's going back to Hong Kong and doing these sort of movies. And to me, the best parts of these movies were the end, the blooper reel at the end as well.
Well, absolutely, sort of I mean, there's various sequences in this where he's the kicking of the clogs, or he's actually trying to spears that have been thrust by him by this African tribe. He ends up with when he first sort of falls from the sky with his faulty memory and stuff, and you know, the escape antics of him leaping around and trying to actually avoid in a fight sequence, avoid being hit, but actually getting hit.
Yeah.
And he did popularise that, which now appears, the blooper reels appear in a lot of things now at the end of films, and it was, you know, it was his invention, basically.
Yeah. So
at the end of every Pixar, he's got that. Yeah.
The end of every Pixar movie now.
Yeah, yeah, that's incredible that they've actually created Blue Presentation. That's a homage if ever there was one.
Exactly.
And my other film then to mention, since you've exhausted your list.
I have indeed, yeah.
Is Who's Minding the Store?
Okay.
1963, directed by Frank Tashlin and starring Jerry Lewis, Jill St. John, Ray Walston and John McGiver. Okay. Yeah. Now, basically, if you like a film about misogyny and workplace bullying dressed up as a slapstick comedy, this is for you. But it's definitely of the era where it's just previous towards where it stops being acceptable to be antagonistic towards the idea of there being women in powerful positions.
Okay.
And that they have to be evil to actually occupy those positions. And Jerry Lewis, popularised for his physical slapstick comedy, obviously, but I grew up watching non-wisdom films. And for some reason, watching this and comparing it to the non-wisdom films I watched, Jerry Lewis, much bigger star internationally, but you don't feel he's in the same league as Norman Wisdom. The films were cleverer because they had to be because they were on a smaller budget and things.
Yep.
But I just feel that even the slapstick elements he did with a lot more finesse than appearing in this Jerry Lewis film.
I rewatched my first Jerry Lewis film since I was probably about 7 or 8 years old last year. And again, I know we've mentioned this a few times, mate, about, you know, the golden age of British TV, but Jerry Lewis films used to be on Saturday afternoons, Nutty Professor and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I rewatched The Ladies' Man.
All right.
Awful. Yeah. Absolutely awful. I couldn't find anything funny in it, and especially him whatsoever, mate. But yeah, sorry, carry on. It's true.
I mean, I think non-wisdom was a much more, this isn't a review of non-wisdom specifically, but it seems to be turning that way. But I mean, you know, he was a multi-instrumentalist who could sing and kind of stuff.
Troubling Store was far better. Yeah.
And I mean, he had the lovable down and out element much more able to carry it off than Jerry Lewis was. Mm. And none of the female figures in his films were treated with such contempt as it seems to be that in this film, the sort of matriarchs of the business and the family seem to be just vilified completely. So yeah, this is meant to be one of the better Jerry Lewis films, other than the ones that have been remade by Eddie Murphy, Nutty Professor and stuff. But looking back, it just doesn't stand up to retrospection the same way that some of the other comedians of the time did. So it's certainly the physical comedy, I don't think, is as good as Jackie Chan's, to be fair.
Oh God, nowhere near it, I'd have thought, yeah.
No, I mean Jackie Chan, the pratfalls and the way he carries it off, what he's looking towards, predates Jerry Lewis. And maybe they've got the same influences, but I can certainly say who I think honours those influences the best, and it's not Jerry.
Certainly not. Yeah, fallen by the wayside, Mr. Lewis. I mean, quite rightly, I mean, yeah, it's one of these, it's of its time, is the phrase I think we have to use now, don't we? Of its time.
Yes, I think that's the best way to, or the easiest way to excuse the
shortcomings.
Some of the attitudes within it, and plot isn't marvellous either. So yeah, maybe not add that one to your list.
No, that's at the very bottom, that one, mate.
So you said you had some also-rans.
I mean, What's Up Doc, we mentioned earlier, which you watched.
I haven't
seen it for a little while, but I just remember it being a real good sort of homage to those sort of screwball Cary Grant type comedies of the 30s. It was just this real, isn't it a dinosaur bone? Is the MacGuffin in that? It's all something to do. He's a professor, isn't he? And
he's due to be married. He's trying to get a scholarship, well, not a scholarship, he's trying to get a grant from a rich guy who's eccentric. In order to do this, it's to do linguistics, isn't it?
Is it dinosaur bones bringing up babies?
Music, yeah, it's to do with music.
Yeah.
Something to do with musical translation and stuff, I seem to remember.
Yeah.
As you say, it's a MacGuffin that's not really important, but it's a farce, really, isn't it?
I remember it being
what a farce should be.
Yeah, I remember it being quite well made and quite big budget as well. You know, that sort of went back to those sort of Keystone Cop chases, if I remember rightly. I think it's set in San Francisco, up and down the hills there, and things, you know, and people walking across the road with panes of glass and fruit.
There's a couple of scenes of that at the end. That's in there. It does hark back, I think, and it's possibly the last gasp of kind of thing being able able to be done without it coming across as being no longer the taste. Mm. I think, you know, the taste moved on, and this was the last chance of them doing that kind of thing. I do think Ryan Reynolds, he's playing this nerd and stuff, but he's...
Ryan Reynolds?
No. Who do I mean?
Ryan O'Neill.
Sorry, yeah, Ryan Reynolds. That's completely different, yeah. Ryan O'Neill, I do think that he certainly is too attractive and athletic to carry off this nerdy professor type role, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that lets it down a little bit. I don't think it's necessarily he did a bad job of it. I think maybe they should have tweaked the character to actually make it fit a bit more with him, because there's a slight discrepancy there watching it.
Also, the dinosaur bone is bringing up Baby, which is Cary Grant and Catherine Hepburn, and Cary Grant is playing the Ryan O'Neill role, basically.
You know,
put a pair of glasses on him, and it is him, sort of thing. So, yeah, that's where that comes from. Did you have any more? I've got a couple more here.
Who's that girl?
That's on my list, yeah, just as a mention.
I didn't rewatch, but I have watched it in the 80s. I think it's very much of its time, really.
Yep.
I think it's a vehicle for the star of it rather than a film in itself, really. Good song out of it, anyway.
Yeah, it's a perfect vehicle for Madonna at the time, isn't it? It's a perfect snapshot of 82, 83, whenever it was,
What else have you got?
I had two Peter Sellers movies, but can't really comment on them because I haven't seen them for so long. I had What's New Pussycat and What's Up Tiger Lily.
I have seen Tiger Lily previously, but can't remember much about it.
Yeah.
But What's New Pussycat I did actually watch.
Yeah.
And it's a complete and utter 60s farce.
Yeah.
Very much taken from the Woody Allen influence as well. Yeah. You know, you can see his involvement in it and why it's the way it is. But it didn't make the cut for me, just because I think that despite, you know, having some names in it like Peter O'Toole and stuff like that, I think it just came across as being far too dated and a bit more of a run-of-the-mill farce, really. I mean, there was quite a lot of films done like this around that time, I feel, and so it wasn't stand out enough for me, even though there was some great witty lines delivered by Pete Sellers and Peter O'Toole and stuff. I just felt it didn't actually go beyond that. The rest of it was just padding for your eyes, really. Plot didn't do a great deal.
We've missed a Best Picture winner, actually, on our list.
Have we?
Yeah. I'm going to say 41.
That's
How Green Was My Valley. Yeah. Best Picture winner, again, I don't think I've actually seen it, to be honest, so I can't comment on that.
I haven't seen it, so I wouldn't be able to to comment either.
Probably the biggest movie on the list, actually, being the Best Picture winner. Yeah. And the only other one, apart from there was a new film that came out at Christmas with Bryan Cranston called Why Him, which was probably the newest one on the list.
Yes, I saw that on the list and decided I didn't want anything to do with it. Similarly with Dude, Where's My Car? I wasn't even going to go near that. I did consider They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
That was on my list, actually, and that was on my list to watch again. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last one for me, which I didn't get round to watching, but I wished I had, actually, it's from 1957. It's Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, Jane Mansfield, Tony Randall. Just your sort of average sort of cheesecake late 50s in the vein of 7 Year Itch type thing. But for me, it holds particular interest because the screenwriter, we've already spoke about how great screenwriters and how important they are.
Mm.
George Axelrod was the screenwriter for the 7 Year Itch, but also Breakfast at Tiffany's and The Manchurian Candidate. So again, bit of pedigree behind that one. And I remember seeing it a long time ago, but apart from that, I can't remember too much about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to comment because I haven't seen it.
No.
So I'm aware, the title is recognisable to me. But I haven't seen it, so it's not one I can comment on. But that's not a deliberate thing of me not seeing it. Not like I said, like Dude, Where's My Car? Or Why Him? And there was another one. Are We There Yet? Which I think is Ice Cube or something like that.
That's ringing a bell, Ice Cube. Yeah, I was going to say Sinbad, but it's Ice Cube, isn't it?
It's something like that. So yeah, that was another which I decided to just give a miss to. So apart from that, I can't. The only other one that I did actually watch another one for possible inclusion, but it didn't actually make the cut.
Yeah.
Was Who Done It, which is Abbott and Costello.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Which is, very much just a vehicle for them to be able to do their bit, obviously. But it wasn't without merit, but, and thankfully films of that ilk and of that actual time frame, they were short and sweet. Again, like the Jackie Chan films, they were just a vehicle in order for the stars to do their bit. And although I was always a Marx Brothers fan more than Abbott and Costello or anything, they do exactly what you expect of them. And I can't play them down for that. And they're self-reverential. With the whole who's on first base bit, that actually gets a bit of a nod.
Is that in there again? Because that's in every bloody movie.
No, it comes up. Yeah, because they do actually start sort of referencing it as a meta thing across the films after it got so popular.
Yeah.
And this point, Abbott wins a radio, and he turns the radio on, and it's got that sketch coming out, and he sort of gives it a couple of seconds. He goes, "Oh, not those guys again." Let's switch it off. they've actually been a bit meta. Which is a bit more clever than they possibly could be, but it is basically just a bit of slapstick and opportunity for them to do their straight man clown routine.
The usual.
And that's what people expect from them, and that's what you get. So there's no complaints can be made about that. But that was really the sum total of the ones I was able to speak about as far as with question marks in, because as I say, a lot of them I hadn't actually got around to watching that they shoot horses and such.
Yeah. So. It was a tough subject. As I say, 1,500 titles on IMDb, but to actually find any that are notable and worthy of discussion was, a little bit difficult, which is why I tried to be a bit quirky with the Bugs Bunny and F for Fake and things like that.
Good shouts, I think, livened it up, because there were other ones you could have gone to that are
more obvious.
Weren't actually worth talking about.
But no, that's been great, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for coming on and providing us with your input and actually shedding light on some films that I need to go away and look at as well, rather than just you taking away a list. And hopefully the listeners will have... there might be some films in there that they want to list, and they might be warned off some other ones. So where can people find your podcast then before we go?
We're on the usual places at Twitter, the Stinking Paws podcast, which is the classic movie podcast that I do with Charlie. The website is probably the easiest first sort of stop there, and it's stinkingpaws.libsyn.com. And the Rainbow Valley podcast, which is the fairly new one, we're about 8 episodes in, which is, as I say, my passion project on the history of the 1960s and all things swinging and groovy, is rainbowvalley.libsyn.com.
Fantastic. And they are two shows that I greatly anticipate coming out and each time and look forward to listening to as soon as possible. So I recommend them for other people to go to. So thank you again for coming on.
Pleasure, sir.
And
pleasure.
For the audience, thank you for listening, and hopefully we'll hear from you next time.
Cheers. Bye.
Take care.